This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. For more than three decades, Fiona Ritchie has led public radio audiences on a weekly tour of Celtic music on her NPR program Thistle and Shamrock. The show has delighted audiences across the country with a blend of tunes and commentary about Celtic traditions. Fiona Ritchie was born in Scotland, ventured to North Carolina in the early 80s, where she began her public radio career at WFAE in Charlotte. Most recently, Fiona Ritchie has co-authored a book, Wayfaring Strangers, is just out today. And co-author Doug Orr and Fiona Ritchie have been exploring the evolution of Celtic musical traditions from Scotland to Appalachia. They're going to do a reading tomorrow evening at Motorco in Durham. They're going to be in Asheville as well later in the week. But right now, Fiona Ritchie is my guest on The State of Things. Welcome. It's good to have you here.
It's good to be here, Frank. I love coming to this station. And it's a lovely physical environment to explore. But also there's a real sense of the history of public radio, just walking around WUNC, looking at the old photographs on the walls, and remembering how long public radio has been part of this community. And indeed, since the Thistle and Shamrock started, this is one of my charter stations. So,
did you get up here much from Charlotte when you...
I did. I used to come up I like to think of them as sort of lost weekends. I was really good friends with a band called Touchstone, who used to live here in town, and they were great pals with the Red Clay Ramblers back in the 80s. So I used to come up and stay with my good buddy Claudine Langell, who lived in town. And lots of people who are listening might remember Claudine, and Trina Nichonel, who was a wonderful Irish singer who lived in Chapel Hill. And they would entice me up. It didn't ever take much to convince me to come up for a concert that might be going on and then stay for the weekend. And so I really got a sense of the place during those years.
What was it like here and in Charlotte in the 80s? Was there a sense, did people have a sense of the musical tradition that they were heir to here in North Carolina?
I think people had a sense that they were in a hotbed of great music, and you only needed to look around, listen around, to see that, you know, we were just, it was an embarrassment of riches musically, from, you know, old time music to country music, jazz, you know, blues, all of the music that North Carolina is famous for. As far as where its origins may have been in terms of the musical migration that we've explored in this book, I'm not so sure people were that aware of it. Or even that aware of maybe who they were. When I was a student at UNC Charlotte for one semester, I came over as a sort of a innocent, wide-eyed Scottish girl. And people would say, well, where are you from? And I would say, I'm from Scotland. They would go, oh, I'm Scotch-Irish. And I thought for long enough that meant that one parent was Scottish and the other parent was Irish. And it took me a long time to realise they were talking about a much older connection, and that I would go, oh, really? Where are you from? And they would go, well, I'm from Charlotte.
I love that you got the whole, that you understood what Scots, or investigated what Scots-Irish really meant after you came here, because you began your life in Scotland. Tell us about that, growing up in Scotland.
Well, I was born on the west coast of Scotland. The River Clyde is a famous river of Scotland. It flows from, as a tiny stream up in the hills, and comes out through the great city of Glasgow, where it continues on, opens out onto the west coast, and there are lots of little ferry towns there servicing peninsulas, servicing islands, and indeed a source of emigration at one point. Boats sailing up from Glasgow and from the River Clyde ports, such as where I was from, to Ireland and over to America, being on the west of Scotland. If you sail out and skip around the north of Ireland, the next stop is, you know, somewhere like Newfoundland or Boston or somewhere. So I grew up with a sense of the sea. We also were opposite an American naval base, and so American sailors would come off duty across the Clyde in these little launches, and they would land in Gourock, where I lived, this little ferry port on the Clyde, for their leave and getting the train up to Glasgow. And I actually thought, therefore, that when we looked out our window, that those hills on the other side of the river, that must be America, because these sailors would come over. So in my mind, that was America. And so I grew up with a sense of that, and a sense of living on the sea, a sense of boats. And my mum always used to say it was tears that made the Clyde, because of all the struggles that had been lived out along the river, and indeed all the emigration from those shores. So it was tears that made the Clyde, and that's where I grew up.
Well, you did. Did you grow up listening to music, and was that an important part of your life?
Radio was an important part of our life. The radio was almost always on. I remember hearing the Beatles for the first time when I was really tiny. But my mum really liked Scottish country dance music programmes, and so she would put on, by Scottish country dance music, this is quite a formalised version of our fiddle and accordion music tradition, where the tunes are played in strict tempo for specific dances, reels, strathspeys, jigs, danced in sets. So it's quite a formal form of the music. And mum liked to put that on, and she would like to dance around the house, and we would dance around the house. So I have a sense of this Scottish country dance music drifting out the radio. But the radio was always on, so it was classical music, it was news and public affairs, it was show music, you know, the Rodgers and Hammerstein, and of course all the emerging pop music of the day. So that was really how I heard my music, was through the radio, and all the vinyl exchanges of our teenage years, where you would walk about with a status symbol album tucked under your arm and lend it to friends. So that was my musical awakenings.
But so, and anybody listening to you now, and anybody who knows your program, The Thistle and Shamrock, would assume that that was it. You were hooked and you were bound to create a radio program that would share this wonderful tradition with the whole world. But no, you were interested in literature and then later psychology. Tell us about your early interests.
Yeah, I mean, I did like music, but my musical tastes then, as indeed they are now, were very eclectic. I really enjoyed sports at school and at university. I played loads of field hockey, and I've got all the sort of scarring down the fronts of my shins to prove it. I did lots of track and field athletics to quite a high level when I was at high school and university, and that was a big part of my life too. Although I always thought that I really didn't have the application to be a successful athlete, because it seemed to me that there were three parts of university life. There was the studies, there was the social life, and then there was the athletic life. And I didn't want to fail as a student. That was important to me. But social life really began to eclipse other pursuits more serious in the way of athletics. But those were very important things to me. And skiing, I did a lot of skiing at that time, and I've since rediscovered that in a most wonderful way with my kids. But psychology was what I studied at university. I went there to study English and Scottish literature, but I ended up being drawn more and more to the people that were offering the subject of psychology. And there were some very interesting people in the University of Stirling Psychology Department, including a man who worked very closely with Jane Goodall in all her chimp studies, and just some inspirational sorts that made you kind of want to learn more about what they were researching. And that was what eventually led me to come over to study here as well.
We are meeting the host of The Thistle and Shamrock, Fiona Ritchie, today on The State of Things, talking about her life and her start in her radio career at WFAE in Charlotte, and a new book called Wayfaring Strangers. We'll talk more about that later on as well. But tell us about that. What brought you to Charlotte?
Well, I came over, there was a chance to spend one semester at UNC Charlotte. It wasn't an exchange program as such, but they had established a faculty exchange where they were swapping out professors. And as an offshoot of that, I got an opportunity to come over and spend some time in Charlotte. And it was during that time that I followed my instinct, which is always to turn on the radio. I remember I borrowed a radio from someone, popped it in my little room on campus, popped it on, and loved all the, you know, the album rock and all the kind of southern rock that I was discovering as well, and country music and things. But I couldn't find anything. I found a classical music, but I couldn't really find the news and public affairs and the kind of public radio sensibility that I grew up with the BBC. It just didn't really seem to be there. When I came back to Charlotte after I graduated at home and decided to come back for a while, I popped the radio on and bang, there it was. It was WFAE. It just signed on the air probably 2 weeks before I arrived. Brand new public radio station. And in an odd, I think when you go and live somewhere else, it frees you up to do more confident things than you would maybe do if you were at home. I would never have done anything like this at home. But I heard the radio station and I just felt physically drawn to go down there, and went down and see if I could get involved in some way. And I was told gently that as long as I realised that with an accent like mine, I wouldn't be allowed near an open mic. You know.
So, wow. They told you you'd never be in radio?
Yeah, they told me I'd never be in radio, but that I was willing to do all kinds of behind-the-scenes things. But, you know, I couldn't possibly be on the air because my accent was too distracting and impenetrable and such. And I said that was fine. I had no great plans. But then what happened was they needed to cut promos for all these BBC drama programmes like Lord Peter Wimsey and Sherlock Holmes and Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. And so suddenly they realised I could put on these fake BBC accents and these sort of very plummy, you know, tune in for Lord Peter Wimsey. And so I would do these promos and they thought, well, that was great. And somehow that opened the door to me being actually in the studio instead of outside the studio.
So did you actually fake up kind of various British accents?
For those promos I did, yeah. Absolutely.
Because, you know, Scottish would have been close enough for the folks here in North. I mean, seriously, it's like, oh, yeah, he's from England.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm part of that thing.
But then when I did finally just relax and speak the way I speak and got on there and did a program of music from where I'm from, one woman called the radio station and said, you know, I like that music program, but I think that's absolutely ridiculous that that woman thinks she has to put on a Scottish accent to present that program. And she said, I've been to Scotland and I know they don't talk like that.
That's amazing. Well, I want to hear more about that and how the show developed and how you first got on the air at WFAE when we continue our conversation with Fiona Ritchie, host of NPR's Thistle and Shamrock. We're going to talk more about a beautiful new book that traces the history of Celtic music and its trip across the ocean, Wayfaring Strangers. We'll talk more about that when we return with Fiona Ritchie on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, the broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us.
And all folks bound to sleep, I think on him was far above the lee long neck, and weep, my dear, the lee long neck, and
this is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Today we're talking with Fiona Ritchie. She's been the host of NPR's Thistle and Shamrock for more than 30 years. She's on tour right now with a beautiful new book, Wayfaring Strangers, that traces the history of Celtic music right to this region from its origins in the British Isles. So I want to hear more about how you start, because you were discouraged at first when you went to WFA from being on the air. Your accent would be off-putting. You did develop a program. Where did you get the idea for that program, and how did it find its way to air?
Well, first of all, when you just said there 30 years, more than 30 years, that kind of blows me away. I came back over because I had met somebody when I was in Charlotte as a student, and he was a professor at UNCC, and we got married. I made an early marriage, came back for love, you know, and we really had some chats about it together. I remember at the time we'd gone back for Christmas, and he sadly has passed away 10 years ago, but he and I used to like to go to some of the local pubs, and I'd talked about doing a radio program of some of these this music. Actually, I'd brought over about a dozen albums with me to ward off homesickness, and they were Battlefield Band and the Tannil Weavers and many of these artists. And I'd been invited by the very person who said, I'm sorry, but your accent is completely unacceptable, to do a little one-off special with this music. So I'd done that. But then when I came home at Christmas, I thought, well, if I'm going to do more of that, I'll need more record albums. So we went round, my husband at the time and I went round collecting these albums. And I thought, well, I need a name for this programme. And I was looking up at the names of pubs, and it was always the something and something, you know, the Rose and Thistle, the Belt and Buckle, you name it up. And I thought, well, the Thistle and Shamrock. And it sounds kind of naive now, you know, it does sound almost like the kind of name that a young person might even dream up. That's what I imagined. But along the way, I realised that the name was quite difficult for some people to say, you know, the Thistle and Shamrock. Mm-hmm. And also it was its own sort of almost little cliche. And so I think I thought I might try to change the name of the programme. And everyone said, but you can't. It's a fantastic brand. You can't possibly ever change the name of that programme. So I grew back into loving it well enough. And so that was way back in 1981, And I must say, my husband at the time, Nace Toner, who's, as I say, since passed away, was very encouraging of me to start this radio programme. And although the marriage didn't survive as long as this programme, he and I remained friends, and he was a great supporter of it all. And basically, I just did it as a volunteer hobby, really, on the airwaves of WFAE, where I worked at the time as promotion and development director, raising funds to keep the station on the air, going out and talking to optimist clubs and rotary clubs about public radio, and running on-air fundraisers. And then at some point, the programme went national in 83. There just seemed to be it seemed to fall into a gap that nobody realised existed. There was a great appetite for it. Loads of stations wanted to pick it up, and at some point I thought, well, you know, I really don't have time to do this and be the development director at WFE, so I'll have to give up this radio programme. And I must have woken up in the middle of the night and thought, no, I think it has to be the other way around. And then at some point along the way, you know, WFAE was a great place to be. The programme originally had gone through what was then American Public Radio, Public Radio mm-hmm. International. The programme then moved location to NPR. And around about that time, I thought I really wanted to get back and locate myself back where the music was mm-hmm. and bring that kind of authenticity. And that I really felt I should be back over there, and also for family reasons. So I moved lock, stock and barrel. And this, I have to say, I did it before technology really was set up to help me do that. So, you know, now it's quite easy to work long distance. We have the internet. We can work away with emails. We can upload programs to servers via broadband. But I went over before technology had caught up with my intended lifestyle. So it was fax machines, and it was FedEx envelopes with reels of tape. And
mailing cassettes to your friends.
That's right. And it was all very... It was all a bit more of a mad adventure to try and work like that and do the programme in a transatlantic way. But I'm glad I did. I think it really helped the programme to grow.
Was the programme at first, when you were still a volunteer and when you were doing this as a one-off, was it more or less the programme it is now? In other words, the music with a lot of explanation, understanding in the context, or were you just kind of playing the hits and hoping folks out there remembered and loved them?
Well, interesting. I was on a journey of discovery into the music myself, mm-hmm. I suppose. And from the very earliest programmes, what you would have heard was really quite a young person exploring the music, playing the things that I liked in a very earnest way, wanting to help people to understand. And maybe also as a Scot, coming to live overseas, realising how little people really knew about where I was from. The sorts of stereotypes, not unpleasant ones, but, you know, clumsy little stereotypes that people might have about Scotland or where I was from. And so there was this little opportunity, I suppose. I don't know how conscious it was, but suddenly there I was on a microphone, and I had an opportunity to share a bit more context and a bit more substance about where I was from as a proud Scot, and also to make the connections with Irish music that I felt were maybe had not been fully explored over here, with the slightly kind of almost cartoonish St. Patrick's Day type scenarios that you can see that are fun, but that's not all what Irish music is about. And I just wanted to share. It was a bit of an evangelism streak in me, I suppose.
But how much then did you really have to learn that you actually didn't quite know? How much of that had you learned from the moment, or have you learned from the moment you started the program?
Yeah, well, there's been a great journey for me as well. I had plenty of knowledge to get me going, for sure. And so my learning, you know, was well ahead of the curve of what I was doing on air. But what happened was that people, when I would go home at Christmas time to Scotland, I would save up all, I would come and work on Thanksgiving and July 4th and things, and save up all my holidays at WFAE so I could get a nice little chance to go home at Christmas. People very quickly cottoned on to what I was doing again before there was social media networks to do that. But I guess the small independent record labels of Scotland and Ireland that I had called, I'd literally looked on the backs of albums, and look, I'm holding my hands in an exact size of an LP cover. I would read the contact details and just call them up and tell them what I was doing. And I would go home, and people would ship me these boxes of record albums to take back over, because they realised that there really was no other outlet, and this was an opportunity to have their music shared. So suddenly I was going round to visit lots of these musicians, many legendary sorts of people that now when I look back and I think I was so fortunate to meet them, to interview them and to engage with them on about their music. So in doing all of that, I very quickly learned who were some of the real tradition bearers and who were the kind of revivalists and the people who were working with the music.
I think that's the other thing. There's always this tension from when you are from the place where the music began. The music is still evolving back there. And the folks who remember it fondly are a bit nostalgic here. And so, in a way, they're preserving some of the older styles and the older form and some of their favorite records. Meanwhile, back in the British Isles, the music is evolving. To what extent or when did you decide, if you did at some moment, that tracing that part of the history or talking about that part of the story, it's still changing, folks. It's not just old ballads from the 17th century.
Yeah, well, that came with growing confidence as a broadcaster, I suppose. And Frank, you'll know this too, that you start to feel that your audience is with you and that they will go with you. And so initially I thought, well, I must make sure I play some of this artist and I must make sure I play equal amounts of this and I mustn't miss out that. And I was very diligent about it because I thought, oh my goodness, suddenly I was in this position and I had to make sure I did it right and I didn't shortchange any particular important person. And then, and also maybe I shouldn't play something that was too contemporary in case people, this bothered them. And then I thought, wait a minute, who is this person that I'm trying to please? Who is this person sitting on my shoulder judging me? Nobody. And nobody was saying you have to hit these targets or tick these boxes. And I realised that it was actually down to me to shape the story myself, share it the way I wanted to, let people complain if I'm ruffling their feathers. But my sense was that most people were happy to come along for the ride and to discover the music with me, that there was quite an appetite to hear contemporary innovations on tradition. And that the more I kind of did that and you know, people knew I was in it for the long game, that I would eventually return back to something more rootsy as well. And that if they hung in there with me, that we would cover all the bases.
Well, you know, along those lines, I know you tell a wonderful story about being, I think you were in the mountains, but I think it was Asheville where you sort of were invited to or heard about the Highland Games were going on. Maybe this was your first encounter with the games. And it's a great story you tell about sort of how you were dressed and they were dressed. And I just love the story.
Well, I was over, it was when I was a student, and my time as an exchange student, if you like, you know, one semester and the summer that followed it was coming to a close. I was getting ready to go back home and someone said, well, you know, you should go up to the Highland Games up at Grandfather Mountain. And I to be honest with you, my first reaction was, no, I can do that at home. You know, people had been taking me to tailgate parties and drive-in movies, and I hadn't really had a chance to hear old-time music that first time out. That was when I came back. But as a student, I was just kind of having an American collegiate experience. I'd been to the beach and I'd done this and that. And I thought to myself, why would, on one of my last precious weekends, why would I want to kind of go to Highland Games when I can go home and do that all the time? And then someone said, no, you've got to go. They speak Elizabethan up there. And I thought, okay, now you've intrigued me. So anyway, up I went. And I'm really glad I did, because it was incredible to see. I could not believe the size and the scale of it from some of the intimate Highland Games, which are very many of them in Scotland. It's a very, very vibrant tradition and scene. We've got Highland Games in our own village. But the scale of the thing and the amount of people, the range of clothing that people thought was traditional Highland wear was an eye-opener. So I was wearing a pair of cut-off jeans and a UNC Charlotte T-shirt. And there I was rubbing shoulders with all these very American Scots in full Highland regalia. And it was incredible. I mean, it was probably a little culturally confusing for me. But I remember it was also extremely hot, very humid. And I retreated up the hillside just to kind of take in the scene and to get a little bit of fresh air. And I noticed a family sitting well above. Now, it looked to me like they hadn't actually come through and maybe even bought tickets to come in. It looked like they'd come over the ridge and were watching the scene from above. And do you remember these cassette tape recorders that you used to put the cassette in, and they had a thick coiled microphone that you would pull out like an old phone cord? Mm-hmm. And he had one of these, a really battered old machine, and his kids were sitting. And I must say, they looked like they were not of great means. They were dressed quite simply and they were sitting up the hill and they looked like they'd walked a long way. His wife was sitting with the three or four kids, and he was standing out in front with this cord stretched away out, and they were all sitting in reverential silence, and he was recording the sound of the pipes, or we would say the skirl of the pipes, that was, you know, the bagpipes is a wonderful instrument to hear out in the open air like that. And so it was literally blowing, drifting up on the breeze, and he was recording this, and the tears were streaming down his face. And this is radio, you can't see, but the hairs are sort of standing up on my arm just thinking about it. He was very moved by this. So when he finished, I said, "So do you like the pipes?" Thinking it was the music of the pipes. He said, "Well, we're Scotch-Irish. This is our heritage." And he was just so moved by it. And I thought I wanted to find out a little bit more about it. I wasn't sure what he meant by that. But I knew that for him, this was his culture. And I tell you what, looking at them, you could kind of see it as well. They just looked like they were of that lineage. And that was the kernel that planted that. I thought, I want to find out a little bit more about that. And then it was discovering the music, the old-time music, the balladry of the Appalachians. And suddenly it was like an opening of a gates for me of just an insatiable appetite for it all, really.
So you have been doing the show ever since. That was kind of a wonderful moment. I think about that, too, this notion of authenticity, which is going to come up when we talk more about the book. And this idea that we have of what it is that is Celtic music. I mean, so there are the Scottish Highlands. They dress in a certain way. And then there are the Lowlands where they don't dress that way. And that's all Scotland. And if you want to know about Scotland, you need to know about all of that, right? I mean, that's – and I'm guessing the music is a little different, too.
Well, you know, I don't think I'm exploding anyone's romantic notions if I say that the notion of, you know, Celtic music, it's possibly a convenient label, really, from a music marketing point of view. Is that okay to say?
Of course, I'm not upsetting anyone.
You know, but we need to call it something. So loosely, Celtic music or music from Celtic roots would be music from all over Scotland, from all parts of the British Isles, Ireland, parts of Europe, parts of the USA, Canada, that share that route. But I think I like to be really quite broad with it all and not rigid about what Celtic music is. And, you know, as far as the idea of Scotland and Scots stereotypes, I really think it's kind of amazing that just, you know, a couple of weeks ago or in the last month, that suddenly people all over the world are suddenly really aware of Scotland as a contemporary country doing very modern things through our political process.
It was strange seeing all that footage and seeing people dressed just like me. I didn't know they dressed that way, but there they are. And they're having elections. That's what we do here, my goodness. So speaking of that, how do you feel about all that?
Well, I'll tell you what, it was an incredible process. We're talking about the Scottish referendum on independence. And, you know, you've just been getting the news on this in recent times, reasonably enough. We've been getting it daily for about 2 years. It's been the longest political campaign in British history, and for a really good reason, because this was a very a crucial decision being made. It's not something that just was dreamt up overnight. I mean, the first inklings of people wanting to talk about Scotland separating back out of the UK would go back to about 1927, and it's grown momentum in different kind of not in a sort of straight line, but you know, there's been swells of support for this notion. And just to be clear to people, Scotland and England signed acts of union, so coming together as equal partners in a union in 1707, 100 years after the crowns had united, and King James VI of Scotland went down to England to become King James I of Scotland, England, Wales and Ireland at the time. So we united our royal families, and then 100 years later, for lots of circumstances at the time, including near bankruptcy of Scotland due to a bad investment in which 25% of the national chest, if you like, was invested in a failed colony in Panama, believe it or not. And so there was a sort of an opportunity, I think, that England saw of, well, here we can unite the Scots in one kingdom. We were always a bit threatening because we always had France was our ally. And so England was kind of flanked with these two countries that would ally with one another against them. So there was an opportunity to sign the Scots into a partnership. So it wasn't that England conquered us or that we became subjects. Scotland and England signed acts of union and became partners. So what we were looking at in the recent referendum was dissolving that act of union and Scotland returning to its status as an independent country. So people either voted yes or no. It was just a simple referendum in an unprecedented move. They extended the vote, they lowered the voting age to 16 so that 16 and 17 year olds could participate in the process that would affect their futures hugely, and they felt that they should be part of it. So in doing so, we have created the most politically aware young people that you can imagine. My daughter is 16, voted. Her friends, they talked about very little else for weeks leading up to it. It was there was a real feeling of kind of people power. It was a grassroots campaign, very positive. There was a sense that we were in some way, I don't mean to sound too grand about it, but it felt like we were somehow, you know, almost reinventing and re-establishing the idea of democracy. People were excited about politics, engaged with politics. And so, and a lot of that was led culturally. So there was a lot of musicians and artists very much involved, particularly on the yes, independence side. And it's more difficult to sell the idea of no, let's not do that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, so there tended to be a lot of that. And it really was a triumph for democracy, because in many areas, more than 90% of people came out to vote. The island of Jura had a 100% voting record, and overall it was about 85%. So I would say that it was a wonderful kind of festival of democracy. And for that reason, I think it's been a really important process, regardless of what the outcome was going to be, which we've voted to remain part of the UK.
Remain part. Exhausting, though, I would guess. Exhausting.
It was exhausting. And I mean, in that respect, I'm actually glad to be sitting here with you, because it felt like a really nice time to take a break from Scotland, actually. We've been through a big one, and it's nice to kind of take a wee bit of distance from it.
Fiona Ritchie, the host of The Thistle and Shamrock. For more than 30 years, she is my guest. We're going to talk with her more about her career and a brand new book, Wayfaring Strangers, The Musical Voyage from Scotland to and Ulster to Appalachia. That conversation continues on The State of Things. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. My guest this hour, Fiona Ritchie, host of NPR's Thistle and Shamrock, and the co-author of a new book out today, Wayfaring Strangers. It's a book that includes a CD so you can hear the music as you read about the story.
'Twas in the merry month of May, when rosebuds were a-swelling, sweet William Moore the love of Barbara Allen.
That is the song Barbara Allen, sung by Dolly Parton, from the CD that accompanies the new book, Wayfaring Strangers, co-authored by my guest, Fiona Ritchie. Well, let's talk about that song first. Tell us more about that particular song, Fiona.
Well, Barbara Allen is an old Scottish ballad dating back to antiquity, and it became popular throughout the British Isles and Ireland, and travelled over here with early settlers on the Scots-Irish music migration that we chronicle in our book. And it's probably one of the most widely travelled of all these songs. It was printed up on an old broadside ballad that was distributed as a flyer, if you like, in the day, over in the US, and that really was what locked in its popularity, because it travelled around as a sheet of music, and as a result it locked in a version. Having said that, that's one of those ballads that there must be about 500 verses and the same number of versions on both sides of the Atlantic. And what's lovely about that version you played, which is on the CD that goes with the book, is that some verses are sung in Irish by Mairéadh Ní Mhuine of the band Alton, who I'm sure lots of your listeners are very familiar with, and Dolly Parton sings the Appalachian version, so it sort of locks in the sense of the musical journey that we try to talk about.
Well, tell us more about this book that you have co-authored with Doug Orr. First of all, I have to say it is a beautiful book, the artifact itself, the photographs, the maps, the drawings, all lovely, and it's a wonderful chronicle of this amazing story. Where did the idea come from? When did you start thinking about this?
Well, to backtrack slightly, the appearance of the book, I have to nod to Darcy Orr, Doug Orr's wife, who was our artistic director for the book, and also to UNC Press, who have done a wonderful job by us in helping us realise to the fullest possible extent what we had hoped to realise with this book visually. We first started talking about this. I mean, really, it emerges out of conversations going back many, many years between Doug Orr and myself. Doug Orr was a vice chancellor at UNC Charlotte when I was there as a student, but we didn't meet then. We met when I came back to work at WFAE Radio, because that was one of the parts of the university that he oversaw. And we quickly realised we shared a mutual enjoyment of music. And I was on a journey of discovery, as I told you earlier, of trying to work out where all this old-time music connected to the music back home. It sounded so familiar, and I wanted to find out about that Scots-Irish music migration. Doug, on the other hand, having been a descendant of people who made that migration, was eager to find out about music in Scotland, where he was from. So we were on sort of opposite directions on the same journey, if you like. And the conversations we would have about it slowly coalesced into the sense that we should do something. We should write a book.
You should write a book.
Yeah, we should write. Someone should write a book. And it really, we were both at an event at the Smithsonian Folklife Festival, and they put together a wonderful annual event. And their countries of focus that year were Scotland and Mali in West Africa, and the region of the US that they were using to focus on as part of that festival was Appalachia. So there you had a lot of connected influences. Doug was there, and this is how it's very easy for me to see how long it's been for us to work on this book, because I was at that festival pregnant with my son, who accompanies me here today, and he is almost 11 years old. And that was when we first talked about really doing the book. So he's a kind of a living yardstick of how long this has taken. But it was a transatlantic conversation between the two of us going over the decade.
Well, I can understand why it would take that long. As I say, it's a beautiful story and well told, but so complicated. I mean, we have one Twitter question, I think, that gives you some sense of what you were up against in trying to tell the story of the migration of this music. So Richard Kingston is asking us about Eastern influences on Celtic music, Spain, the Moors, and then I'll add Central Europe, where I believe the bagpipe may have come.
Well, the bagpipe we were talking earlier on, originated in the Middle East, and it's mentioned in the Old Testament. So there are, the Celtic tribes, if you like, were a migrating force of people that travelled through Europe and ended up in the most remote fringes of Europe, which you're looking at the British Isles and Ireland. And that's where they sort of got off the beaten track of all the migrations that kind of tend to mix music up a lot more. And indeed, it has to be said that when we're talking about this music migration, it didn't begin at a certain point and end at a certain point. It's very often chronicled as if it began in the 18th century and petered out after the American Revolution. Well, it certainly didn't. Our book talks about a migration of Scots to Ireland, 20 to 30,000 of them or so in the early 1700s, and then an onward migration in the 18th century of about 250,000 of these Ulster Scots into the United States and on down the Great Philadelphia Wagon Road into southern Appalachia, where they became what we were calling the Scots-Irish. But in fact, the story reaches back thousands of years into these eastern areas that you're talking about. It reaches back across thousands of years of exchange between Scotland and Ireland, which, at one time were really one large shared cultural domain. And then this transatlantic music current, which flowed for so long in the one direction from east to west, eventually starts to come full circle. And today we have this musical current flowing very much in both directions across the Atlantic, thanks to radio, recording industry, mass media. And that's where I have to say, where you really can't sort of say the story begins here, neither does the story have an end.
Well, if language and music come together and blend and form a kind of common tradition, so do the stories and the themes. For example, the ballad Pretty Sorrow, I think, touches on themes that hit home for Scots-Irish, but also resonate for people in Appalachia. Tell us about that song and how that is one way in which we can sort of examine the nexus.
Well, this is an old song that came over from the British Isles. It has connections to an Irish song called The Maid of Bunclody. And it really we can trace it back to the early settlement and migration of these people, because it mentions about becoming a freeholder. This person wishes they could become a freeholder, and that way he might be able to woo his love, because so many people that came over were indentured servants, and they came over and had to serve out their indenture before they could ever become even dream of having a little piece of land of their own. And this is one of the things that the person in this song is craving, so he could win the heart of his true love. And this is one of the earliest of these ballads that was collected in Appalachia.
We are most fortunate to have with us in the studio now Mark Weems on banjo and Judy Glaub Weems on vocal. Julie is featured on the CD that's part of Wayfarers and accompanies this book, and they're going to perform the song Pretty Sorrow.
I came to this country in 1849, saw many a true love, but I never saw mine. Then I looked all around me and found myself alone, and me a poor stranger, and a long way from home. My true love won't have me, this I understand. She wants a freeholder, and I have no land. Though I could maintain her on silver and gold, and all the other fine things that her heart might behold. It's not this long journey that I'm dreading to go, nor the country I'm leaving, nor the debts that I owe. Though nothing so grieves me, nor troubles my mind, like leaving my darling Pretty Sarah behind. If I was a poet and could write a fine hand, I would write my love a letter that she might understand, and send it by the waters when the islands overflow, and think of Pretty Sarah wherever she'd go. If I was a little dove, had wings and could fly to my true lover's dwelling, this night I'd draw nigh in her lily white arms. All night I would stay and watch them little windows for the dawning of day.
Pretty Sarah, a song that is featured on a CD that accompanies the book Wayfaring Strangers, sung live here in our studio by Mark Weems and Julie Glaub Weems. Julie appears on the CD as well. Fiona Ritchie, that song is part of a whole genre of songs, I guess, that talk about the journey itself.
It does, and these songs also have many what's called variants. So, for example, that song mentions 1849, that version of it, but actually it's a much older song and predates that date by some measure. And indeed, most of the Scots-Irish came the century before that, in the 1700s. But, you know, like so many of the songs, people would sing them and change them a little bit to make sense of their own environment. And it was the same with the fiddle tunes. You know, why would you sing, why would you play a fiddle tune and call it Lord MacDonald when you'd left Scotland to leave all that kind of stuff behind you, lords and people like that that had made your life difficult? So you would change its name to something that made sense to you, leather breeches, you know. So tunes changed their names dramatically, but became they were the same tune. And likewise with songs, they would sometimes change the words to make more sense. You know, some of the place names would be lost in their memories, and so they would replace them with place names around them there, or the challenges that they were dealing with. So they might lose some of their mysterious elements that they, because remember, a lot of these ballads were very, very old in Scotland. Many originated in Scotland. Others came from traces of minstrelsy and the troubadour era away into Europe and Scandinavia. So they might be singing about quite supernatural themes and ideas that really didn't make much sense in the Southern Appalachians when they were trying to scrape a living together. So they might sing about things that made more sense to them and change the words accordingly.
You can certainly understand how you could adapt an old tune to with new lyrics. How much did the music itself change in the when the Scots and the Irish got together after that migration and then coming over to North America? Did the music change much?
It changed a lot. I mean, we are very keen to convey that we're not talking about music that was somehow frozen in time and moved across, put into this remote area of Southern Appalachia. So you can say, well, it's in a remote area, therefore this is a time capsule and nothing has changed. On the contrary, what makes it fantastic and interesting is how it's changed and the ways in which it's changed. So what we're looking at really is a musical tapestry in Southern Appalachia. Now, as far as the story we're tracing is concerned, the strongest and brightest threads in the tapestry are the ones that have come over in the Scots-Irish music migration. But in that tapestry, there are other colours and threads from the Germans that they met when they came to Pennsylvania, from whom they borrowed the instrument that became the dulcimer. You know, the English, who also brought over ballads that became part of the ballad canon, other Irish coming directly from Ireland, French influences, and most importantly to note, African-American influences and, you know, the African and European traditions that met with Scots, Irish and Africans coming together was really what characterised a lot of the change in this music. The banjo comes in. Playing your fiddle with your banjo, you're going to have to loosen up that rhythm a little bit, and suddenly you've got a very different sort of a rhythm, and you've got maybe dance rhythms coming in from the Cherokee, who also brought a drumming tradition. So it's a wonderful tapestry of influences from people who, you know, were coming over to this country, sometimes on a very traumatic, enforced migration, but they brought with them the one thing that no one could ever take away from them, which was their musical traditions. And then for people who were indigenous to this area, they had traditions that also were, if you like, greedily sort of grabbed and included into this wonderful tradition that we have in Appalachia.
Beautiful story, wonderfully told in a brand new book. Fiona Ritchie is the co-author of a new book, Wayfaring Strangers, The Musical Voyage from Scotland and Ulster to Appalachia, co-author with Doug Orr. Going to be reading at the, she's host, of course, of Thistle and Shamrock, which you can hear right here at WNC at 7 o'clock. And co-author with Doug Orr. They're going to be talking about Wayfaring Strangers tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, Motorco in Durham. Also going to be at McIntyre Books in Pittsburgh on Thursday. They're going to be in Asheville as well next month. So for details on all the readings, you should go to our website, stateofthings.org, and find out much, much more. And Fiona Ritchie, what a great pleasure. Thank you so much for being here today.
I've really enjoyed it. You know, I have to tell you, and I have to tell your listeners, that I listen to WUNC with the wonders of the internet. So I have this little widget on my computer at work, and if I just want to kind of tune into what's happening in public radio, this is my go-to place. So I do listen from overseas, and maybe I'll send you a tweet sometime and you can read it out on the air.
We'll read it on the air. It's so great working with a radio host, because as the show began, we played a little billboard that begins the show. Our door was still open. Actually, Fiona got up and closed the door to the studio because the show was beginning and instinctively did that. So that's the great thing about working with you, and thank you so much. It's a beautiful book, and we're going to be treated to more music as well, live music right here. Julie Glaub Weems and Mark Weems are going to play us out on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Thank you.
I'm just a poor wayfaring stranger, traveling through this world of woe. Yet there's no sickness, no toil, no danger in that bright land to which I go. I'm going there to see my mother. I'm going there no more to roam.